Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Is this pandemic, the novel coronavirus, changing governance in the United States? Is it bringing about a different form of federalism? With us is Professor Sanford Levinson. Sandy Levinson is a professor of law and political science at the University of Texas. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, and approximately 400 articles, book reviews, and commentaries in professional and popular journals. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Sandy Levinson. It's so good to have you back here.
Delighted to be here.
You know, this pandemic, the novel coronavirus, has again seemed to sort of demonstrate the complicated nature of the government in the U.S. Some people say it's exposed the weaknesses, and some people say it has exposed the strengths of the federalist system. What do you think?
Any question like that has to take into context the fact that we have the world's worst president, and that, you know, the strengths of the federal system are necessary because the president himself is so completely and utterly dismal. And so there is no notion of genuine national leadership being given. The standard argument for the national government, both in 1787 and now, is the kind of externalities argument, that it's fine to have states responsible for what they can effectively regulate where there are no externalities. But if there are externalities, then you want some sort of national coordination so that New Zealand, I assume, can by and large have its own policies without affecting Australia. But I assume that Victoria can't have its own policies that don't affect New South Wales, and so on and so forth. And we obviously have many, many more states than Australia does. And so the consequences of idiotic decisions made by certain state governors can be quite significant. That even if you're heartless enough to say what goes on in Georgia should stay in Georgia, and if the Georgia governor wants to sacrifice a certain number of Georgia lives, then so be it. I don't live in Georgia. Why should I care? The fact is that decisions made in Georgia will in fact impinge on not only states immediately near Georgia, but also New York, even California. So we're in desperate need of coherent national policies. We're not getting them, so therefore there is the fallback on some really very, very admirable state governors, most of them Democratic, but some of them Republican, and they're rising to the occasion. But I don't think this vindicates federalism so much as exemplifies why it is disastrous to have somebody like Donald Trump as a president.
I suppose the argument that one could make about giving some positivity to federalism would be like, in the case of having a disastrous president like Donald Trump.
Right. I mean, it's the insurance policy argument, but you realize that it's a very mixed insurance policy because New York, California are far, far better off because they have Andrew Cuomo and Gavin Newsom as governors. But the states of Georgia, South Dakota, et cetera, are much worse off. And as I said a few moments ago, if it were only the South Dakotans or only the Georgians who had to live, or in this case, die with the consequences of their own decisions as to whom to elect, then you could say, okay, this is what federalism is. But the fact is, we're not insured against dumb decisions made at the state level. And I think that's the problem right now. You know, I'm glad we have the states given the sheer incompetence of the national leadership, but I don't think it vindicates the idea of a very strong federalism in which, you know, which might be defined as the ability of states to resist really sensible policies that right. are being adopted by a trustworthy national government.
So one of the things that seems to be shifting, and this is the thing I found most interesting and what I wanted to talk with you about, is how some states are forming these new sort of alliances, like California with Washington and Oregon, and I think New York with New Jersey, and I can't remember if it was New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And is this going to change at all what our federalism looks like?
Who knows? I mean, I've quoted more than once what may not be the apocryphal statement of Zhou Enlai about the French Revolution and the consequences of the French Revolution. It's too early to tell. You know, we won't know for years what the consequences of this current episode will be. I have speculated, much to the consternation of very close friends and colleagues, that the United States might in fact disintegrate, that there is no very good reason for the people of what I now sometimes call Pacifica to wish to remain in the Union. What are they getting out of it? That, I think, is extreme. I would be really quite shocked if the Union dissolved while I'm alive. There's a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times by Richard Kleindler, I think is his last name. He has a book coming out, I think, in July on the fragmentation of America, in which he suggests that what you're talking about, that is these interstate alliances, really take us back to the Articles of Confederation. And in fact, a couple of governors have evoked the Articles of Confederation. And it's very, very interesting because the Articles of Confederation were described by Hamilton in Federalist 15 as imbecilic, precisely because they didn't allow for a vigorous national government. Hamilton, I think it's fair to say, basically despised the states, particularly in 1787. You can argue that later his views changed a bit. Madison in 1787 had very little that was good to say about states. I view the 10th Federalist as the most anti-federalism document in the canon, because he describes states basically as cesspools of faction that are running roughshod over the liberties of the people. And the only way to guard against that, because you can't really cure the states, the only way to solve that is the so-called extended republic. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you can argue that Madison changed his mind in 1798, 1799, or later. So this is an enduring controversy in American political thought, in American politics. But to put it mildly, returning to the Articles of Confederation is only slightly less radical than simply seceding and setting up some brand new countries. If Joe Biden is elected, I think that he will effectively lead the net, because this isn't going to go away. This is not going to be restricted to a problem of the Trump administration. He will exercise effective national leadership. You're not going to hear Democratic governors talk about the need to enter into Articles of Confederation-like alliances against the national government. if Donald Trump is reelected, then who knows what will happen?
I recall you saying historically that, you know, the problem is the Constitution. Of course, that's what gave us this presidency in the first place.
Right.
So, now, when we look at it, I guess part of what you probably were also saying is it's the confusion in the document because it's sure. not clear.
Sure. The convention was a gathering of 55 people who barely knew one another, who disagreed on a number of essential issues, and who had to engage in ungainly compromises. You know, it's the classic thing of the camels being horses designed by committees. And Madison believed that the Senate, or the part of the Senate that required equal voting power for Virginia and Delaware, was evil. But he said it was a lesser evil. The greater evil would have been no constitution at all. And some of the people who opposed slavery also made very similar arguments, so that nobody got exactly what he, and I use the word he advisedly, wanted out of Philadelphia. In a book I wrote, I distinguished very sharply between the Constitution of Settlement and the Constitution of Conversation. So the Constitution does settle some things, for better or worse. Presidents serve 4-year fixed terms. We can't fire our presidents the way you can fire your prime minister. It is an unfortunate truth that each state has equal voting power in the Senate. The response to somebody who says, well, it's unfair, it's indefensible, is simply, what part of two do you not understand? So the argument can't be made from within the Constitution that it is, illegitimate. But then what lawyers and law schools obsess about really, 100% is what I call the Constitution of Conversation. Who in the world really knows exactly what powers Congress has? Who really knows what powers states have? What the First Amendment means, what the Equal Protection Clause means? The United States Constitution, unlike a number of constitutions around the world, does not specify powers of the states to any significant degree. I mean, some constitutions say states will run their education system, or states in India can decide what languages they'll speak, or indeed states can have their own religions, etc. What we say is that states can't be mushed together or taken apart without their consent, which is not nothing, but it's not a crucial issue of governance. So that American federalism is what philosophers would call an essentially contested concept.
Yeah.
And it's been that way from the beginning.
So medical scholars, who also have legal backgrounds, have argued that this type of pandemic is precisely the reason why we need a strong federal government, arguing against this.
Right.
And yet, in some ways, because we have this, as you call, incompetent president, and I agree with you, in some ways our savior has been the states.
Sure. It's not clear exactly what the moral of that story is, though, even if one agrees with it. I have read, for example, that some gangs in Mexico or the mafia in Italy are currently distributing food to the poor, or, are otherwise behaving in what one would regard as public-spirited, other-regarding ways. One moral of that is the old expression, don't judge people only by the worst things they do. Also take into account, better things they do. All saints have feet of clay. and almost all villains, Hitler may be the exception, but almost all villains on occasion do good things. But I don't know what moral one takes from that with regard to designing a government. I'm not only a lawyer, I'm a political scientist, and in my old age, I think I do define myself much more as a political scientist than as a lawyer, as illustrated by the fact that I'm very, very prone to using the term frequency distribution. That is, you know, over 100 events, would you put more confidence in a centralized government or a fragmented government to solve a given problem? If your answer is that you think 51% of the time the states are more likely to get it right, then you ought to support a quite robust form of federalism. If, on the other hand, you think, well, in truly exceptional situations like this, thank God for the states, that's still not a good argument for adopting strong federalism as a general policy.
At the very beginning of this conversation, we were talking about what happens in Georgia affects, you know, people in Texas, affects people in California, affects people in New York. Do the states have any power at all to limit some of that?
This is a fascinating who knows and who will decide question. That, you know, I can cite you some cases that talk about the fact that we're a union, capital U, and therefore that implies a right to travel from state to state. There's a 1941 case in which California tried to exclude Okies, that is, immigrants from the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, but also, you know, the Midwest, by saying, we don't want you if you're poor. You know, this is the basis of John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath. The Supreme Court held unanimously that California couldn't do that. They didn't agree, interestingly enough, on exactly why not. Four said it was because of the Commerce Clause, or five said it was the Commerce Clause, four said it was because of the Privileges or an Immunities Clause. That seems to suggest that states have to be hospitable to at least the citizens of all other states. On the other hand, there are cases going back to 1824 to 1837 and afterward that talk about quarantine and that say that one of the things that a state can do to protect the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens is to ban diseased cattle. That's the easiest explanation, the easiest example. So if you can ban diseased cattle, or cattle you have some reasonable reason to believe might be diseased because they're coming, say, from stockyards that had hoof and mouth disease, even if this particular cow doesn't yet have it, you could still ban it. So why can't you apply that to people? That, you know, the argument is that we can't keep out people from Oklahoma because they're too poor. But what if we say, well, it's not because they're too poor, it's because we think they might be infected. And, you know, there might be good reason, frankly, to want to try to keep out people from Oklahoma or Georgia or South Dakota because their governors have been remarkably irresponsible with regard to adopting statewide policies. Senator Elizabeth Warren's brother from Oklahoma died yesterday. He died, according to the headlines, he died of coronavirus. Now, I have no idea whether he would also have died in New York or in California, but it at least raises grounds to wonder if he was more likely to get sick in Oklahoma than were he living in California or in New Zealand. And so if that's the case, and especially since we know that a lot of people who are carriers are asymptomatic and therefore can infect other people, even though they themselves are getting through this just fine, then is that a good reason for lifting the drawbridges? As a legal academic, I would have no trouble teaching a class arguing both sides and, you know, asking students which of these arguments they thought was stronger. And I wouldn't dare to say that, well, I will confidently predict that the Supreme Court will say this rather than that. Or for that matter, if the Supreme Court does say that states can't lift drawbridges, would the states necessarily acquiesce, or would they say, we're not going to accept a 5-4 opinion, that we have to expose ourselves to these dangers? You know, if the president makes this, I think, idiotic argument that we have to shut down immigration because of the risk of infection from outsiders, why can't a state say this with regard to outsiders coming from elsewhere? I mean, I have no idea what New Zealand is doing with regard to, you know, not only immigrants, but visitors from abroad. It is indeed an island right, you know, in the middle of the Western Pacific, and it's hard to get to.
The other thing I wanted to get to in terms of these state pacts that we started to talk about too is, do you know how much they're actually doing in coordination?
I assume they're talking with another. I'm assuming they're sharing information. It wouldn't surprise me if states that have masks or states that have certain resources are kind of lending them.
Yep, sharing.
States, but I have no idea.
When I've read that, I started to wonder if, in fact, this could start to shape a different kind of federalism.
It could. Yeah. You know, one could imagine that. But September 11th was supposed to be a defining moment in American history. You can make certain arguments as to why that was true, but it certainly didn't last, obviously, in terms of saying, we're all in this together, we're one strong, united country. George Bush, God help us, looks like a paragon of leadership compared to Donald Trump. And to give him credit, or what I really hate to say, is to give Rudolph Giuliani some credit. They both stepped up to the occasion immediately after September 11th and said what they should have said and created a quite remarkable national unity that didn't depend on oppressing minorities.
Yeah.
That's not the United States we have today. And so who knows what the outcome of this will be?
Well, Sandy Levinson, it's always a pleasure to talk with you and to get your wisdom. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. Sandy Levinson is a professor of law and political science at the University of Texas. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, and approximately 400 articles, book reviews, and commentaries in professional and popular journals.